you will either say, you're right, this isn't my gift, I should move on, or no, I'm going to find a way to make this happen.
Helping you develop the courage to get unstuck and reclaim your purpose in a life that never stops moving. This is Win Today. And now, here's your host, Christopher Cook.
Boy, do we have a show for you today. I am so glad you tuned in. You know, we've all heard the term starving artists, right? The notion is that those who create businesses, products, art, and even services remain hidden in hopes of someday finding success. But today, you'll learn that business and art are not mutually exclusive pursuits. In fact, success in business and in life flow from a healthy exercise of creativity. Joining us today is my friend Jeff Goines. He's the author of the critically acclaimed book, Real Artists Don't Starve. And I'm going to be asking him why your passion can truly pay the bills and why now is the time to share your gift. Jeff, welcome to Win Today. I'm so excited to host you and share your new book with everyone.
Thanks for having me, Chris. Good to be here.
Oh, likewise. You're welcome. Jeff, if I'm not mistaken, this is your fifth book, right?
Yes, it's my fifth book.
Jeff, I got to tell you, I couldn't put it down. I'd love to know, why did you write Real Artists Don't Starve, and what did you hope it would accomplish?
I wrote this book because I think, like you, Chris, I know a lot of creatives. I am a creative, and there is this story that we creatives tell ourselves and tell each other sometimes, which is that the idea that artists starve, that you know, you can't go all in on whatever your art is because you might starve. And I don't like this idea. I don't think it's true. And so it's always bothered me. And as a full-time writer for the past 6 years, I've been able to make a living off of my writing. And it's always bugged me. Like, did I just get lucky? I mean, that happens. I get that. Is this possible for anybody who feels like they have a creative gift to share with the world? And so not too long ago, a friend shared a story with me about how it was not too long ago discovered that Michelangelo was the richest artist of the Renaissance. And this art historian named Rab Hatfield found, through all these old bank records, he found a fortune worth nearly $50 million belonging to Michelangelo, which made him the richest artist of the Renaissance.
Wow.
But at that point, it made him the richest artist who had ever lived. So there were people who, you know, artists who made more money after him. But up to that point, like, he was the richest artist who had ever come along, mm-hmm. and he set a new precedent for what was possible for artists. And there were many artists, painters, sculptors who followed his example in the Renaissance afterwards. So what I thought was interesting about this, Chris, is like that's not the story that we hear today. So I spoke with another professor who is an art historian named Bill Wallace, and he's a biographer of Michelangelo and has been studying the Renaissance for a long time. And he said it was normal. The norm was that artists made good money.
Wow.
And I thought, this is weird. Like, I never heard this growing up. And so what happened a few hundred years after Michelangelo died is the story of the starving artist became more commonplace. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But the bottom line is I think we are overdue for what I call a new renaissance. And so I wrote this book because I kept bumping into people who are what I call thriving artists, people who are making a full-time living off of their creative talents. They're not starving for the sake of their art. And so I shared this book because we're very acquainted with the starving artist story. What we haven't heard very much, I certainly didn't hear it growing up, and most of my friends didn't hear it, is the other side of the story, which is you don't have to starve. You can thrive.
Jeff, that's precisely what I saw in your life. You know, when you and I hung out a year and a half ago in Nashville, and I said, you know, here's someone who is thriving using the gift that God gave him. It's really inspiring to me. Jeff, after only a few chapters, it's really obvious that this book applies not only to artists and musicians, but entrepreneurs and business professionals alike. In chapter one, you made this fantastic statement. You said, quote, "Recreating yourself means letting go of who you were before and accepting a new identity." You went on to say, "We find ourselves on the cusp of transformation. The question to ask ourselves is, are we willing to become our true selves?" I'm really passionate about emotional health and, you know, understanding and living from our identity. How would you speak to leaders of companies and pastors and business professionals as well as artists to embrace and apply this truth to their lives?
Yeah, so I don't know if you're acquainted with Thomas Merton, but
I'm not.
Okay, Thomas Merton is this old Trappist monk. You would dig him. He, you know, wrote about this idea of the false self, which has, you know, been written about in psychology for decades.
Indeed.
And he calls it the shadow self. And he said the problem with the shadow self is that if you stare at a shadow long enough, you begin to believe that it's the real thing. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're talking about leaders. One of the things that I've learned as a leader is you basically have two selves. You have the self that everybody sees, you know, the external self, and then you have the self that you are, the internal self. And I've experienced this even more becoming an author and having more of a public persona, although I kind of cringe at that term.
Sure.
But what that does is, I mean, when you get in front of people, right? Inevitably what happens is you will set expectations for people, and then people will begin to have their own expectations of who you are and what you can do or what you should do. And those could be dead on or not. And mm-hmm. the problem is when we start having an external life, and we all do, right? Like we're all living internally and externally at the same time. There can begin to be the separation, this disintegration between who you really are, which I think is your soul,
yeah,
and then what you're doing, which is your role. Parker Palmer talks about this in A Hidden Wholeness, and he says that it is better to be whole than it is to be good, which I kind of love.
That's so good. Yeah.
So when I was writing this, I mean, this is a topic that I care a lot about too. I don't just want to succeed, as the quote goes, has been attributed to a lot of different people. I don't want to be like most of those people who are climbing a ladder in life only to realize it was leaning up against the wrong wall. And so I started the book Real Artists Don't Starve with this idea that you aren't born an artist. And understand when I say that, I mean, you know, your art is your creative gift. Mm-hmm. Leadership could be an art. Guitar could be an art. Knitting could be an art. So it's just your creative expression that you have to share with the world. And you shouldn't have to starve to do that. But that process of sharing your art begins with a question of identity. And I think that before we can go do some things, we have to become someone, our true selves. And so it's not about being born this way. It's a choice. Who we are and who we become is due to a series of choices that we make. And so to break it down into a framework, I don't think that we fake it till we make it. And there's this very interesting story in the book about Michelangelo, who is kind of the archetype, like he's mentioned throughout the book again and again and again, because he kind of set this new precedent for a thriving artist. And I think it's a model that we can and should return to today. And so one of the things that he did was he went around assuming that he was an aristocrat. So he grew up being told by his dad and his relatives that he came from noble blood, that the Buonarroti family was from nobility. And so he goes through life thinking, I'm noble. They didn't have any money, but when he decides to be an artist, he's not just going to be any kind of artist. He's going to be an aristocratic artist. And he even tells somebody at some point, I never kept a shop as many artists did, meaning I wasn't just some shopkeeper. I worked for popes and princes and the wealthiest people in the world at the time. He took his art very, very seriously because he took himself seriously. And because he did that, he thrived. Now, here's the most interesting thing about that story, Chris. It wasn't true. He wasn't really noble. He didn't have any – like he didn't come from some special line, you know, where he was descended from a prince or from, you know, aristocracy. It was a myth. It wasn't true. But it became true when he believed it. And I think this is true in life. The things that we believe, we become. What we believe about ourselves has a way of coming true. And so the framework is you don't fake it till you make it, but you believe it till you become it. And so I think what Michelangelo did is he believed something, right? I'm noble. He behaved as if it were true. And then eventually what happened? He became noble. When he died, he was a very rich man. And throughout much of his life, he was very wealthy. And he set a new precedent for what was possible for artists to achieve after him. And so this is not a book about becoming rich or anything like that, but it is a book about saying, what is your dream? What is your gift that you have to share with the world? And are you apologizing for that and explaining away why you'll never be able to do this? Because really, deep down inside, you just don't believe you have what it takes.
Oh, Jeff, that's fascinating to me. And all right, it brings up a question, though, because the very next thing you wrote in the book, it's a subhead, I believe it's in chapter one, you asked, who do you think you are? And Jeff, to me, it hits the bullseye about the importance of healing up our belief system. But here's where the challenge comes in for me, and maybe the challenge is posed to you all joined in this conversation. What I'm challenged by is what we often witness in these talent competitions, you know, like American Idol and The Voice. Jeff, what if someone really believes in their core that they are a great singer, for example, but then they're obviously not? How do we reconcile your encouragement? We don't fake it till we make it. We believe it till we become it. How do we reconcile your encouragement with those who simply aren't talented in a particular area, but have the passion for that area? Is it more about discovering the unique gift you do have to offer the world then?
So, I mean, here's the thing, right? Like, I believe that we have gifts.
Yeah.
Sometimes that gift is not ability, it's passion. And you and I both know very, very talented people.
Indeed.
People where they're just incredible musicians or athletes or you name it. And yet I have never, maybe you have, I have never met somebody who's like world class, very, very talented, who did not also have a very disciplined practice regimen at some point in their life. Maybe it was early on and they don't do that anymore and they're just quote unquote naturally good. But I believe, and the science on this is, you know, pretty clear. I mean, if you read Anders Ericsson's book, Peak,
sure.
He lays it out like most ability, most skill is earned through lots and lots of practice. So first of all, I would never tell somebody you don't have what it takes. If they have a passion for something, they don't have what it takes.
Yeah.
That's not my call to make. Why? Because every time we tell somebody that, they go like there's somebody who goes on and blows us away, right?
Right.
A great example of this is Colby Calais, the pop musician.
Absolutely.
She appeared on American Idol twice, I think.
Oh, she did. That's right.
And she bombed.
Yeah.
She was rejected, right? I mean, she is one of, you know, the top pop musicians today, selling millions upon millions, tens of millions of singles. She was asked, do you think they were wrong? Like, look at them. They rejected you. Because that's what we say, right? When somebody goes on and becomes successful, they go, man, they blew it. They didn't know. Mm-hmm. She goes, no, they were right to reject me because I wasn't that good. And honestly, the rejection made me take this more seriously. And I think what happens when we pursue a talent, a skill, you know, when we want to chase a dream, and we meet a little bit of adversity, one of two things will happen. You will either say, you're right, this isn't my gift, I should move on, or no, I'm going to find a way to make this happen. And I think it's not that we should keep striving to do things that we're not good at. Like, I am not good with numbers. I'm not great at managing money. I should not go be an accountant. It's just like I've never been good at math. Now, do I believe that if I worked really hard, I could become incrementally better at math? Like, I could become a functional accountant or something? Yeah, I actually do. Like, unless you have some learning disability, most of us can learn new skills.
Sure.
when we apply ourselves. The question is that worth my time? Or could I spend my energy just like getting better at writing and communicating? And the answer to me is very clear. No, I'd rather do that. One, I enjoy it more. Two, I'm building on skills that I already have. But if you have a passion about something, it's not my job to tell you shouldn't do that. What I find trips people up is when they go, like on the American Idol shows, they go, no, I'm really good. I've been practicing. Really? Like, how have you been practicing? And are you getting feedback from a coach? Or are you just singing because it's fun? You know this. Yeah. You know, you right. understand music, Chris.
Sure.
Being great at your craft is not just about you spending 6 hours a day in your bedroom playing around. In the book, I talk about the importance of apprenticeship, which I think is a lost art.
Yes.
And so if you have a passion for something, then go find a master to apprentice under. And I think the opportunities for that today are practically limitless. You can do that with this podcast right now.
Absolutely.
You can learn. Right. You can listen in on a conversation that you otherwise wouldn't be a part of. You can go listen to, to some of the world's leading minds for free on iTunes. You can read blogs and books and get into the minds of masters in just about any trade, any craft, if you want to. But it does not end there. What apprentices do is they learn from the masters and then they go apply it. And so that's the thing where I see people get kind of stubborn, where they go, no, that's not what I meant. I'm really gifted. Everybody told me I was special, so I should just be able to do that. Well, that's not passion. That's entitlement. And so when somebody says they've got a passion, what it really comes down to, Chris, I think, is they've got to be willing to do the work. And at some point, you have to put yourself under the tutelage, the teaching of somebody who is better than you. And they can tell you, here's what you're doing wrong. Here's what you can be doing better. But I don't believe like this thing that like we're all given a certain number of talents. We don't have to cultivate those or grow those and turn those into skills. Yes, I've seen giftedness. And even Sure. the experiences are gifts. But I believe that I'm good at writing because growing up, my mom read me the dictionary. Like that's a weird thing, right? Like that's not something that every 9-year-old gets. And I don't know why she did that. She just loved English and she wanted to share that with me and I loved it too. So is that a gift? Is that a skill? You know, where does one end and the other begin? I don't know. What we are in charge of is not our genetics, not where we came from, or even we can't even control our upbringing. What we can control right now is where we spend our time and how we practice. If you're passionate about something, find somebody who is great at that thing and bring yourself under their teaching. Let them be the master, you become the student, and do everything that they say. This is not something that's very popular today, and I think it shows in our work. You know, it shows in the shoddiness of the work that many people are doing today, and even the work ethic that we see in the workforce in many places. Like, the thing that we're missing is apprenticeship.
I hope this really hits the bullseye on so many of you joined in this conversation, because listen, I know there are a lot of you who are very, very gifted and have a desire to do something. And to echo what Jeff just said, find someone who's better than you and then show up and do the work. Put in the time. No one said this is going to be easy.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are things that you can be doing. And I talk about this in the book. Right. There are things that you can be doing to make more money.
Certainly.
Right?
Yep.
But it doesn't begin there. It begins with skill. I do believe that money follows skill, right? I think
Correct.
Money follows attention. Attention follows skill. And so in the book, we walk through kind of these three steps. Mindset. First, you have to believe that it's possible.
Right.
Market. Then you've got to get your work in front of people. So first, you got to change your mindset and start doing the work, then you've got to get the work in front of the right people. And then eventually we can, you know, here's how you actually make money. But none of these things work if you're not doing the work, That's if you it. Are not growing in your craft. But I'm not one of those people, Chris, who go, well, you're either born this way or you're not. I think skill is cultivated.
Yes.
Greatness is grown. It is not born. And yeah, we're all dealing with the raw material that we've been given genetically, and that's enough. That's enough to turn that into your version of greatness. I don't think it helps to look at what this guy or that girl is doing. You've got to stay in your lane and stay focused on your work. But you know, yeah. I think yeah. we all know when we're doing our best and when we're just kind of drifting along. I used to do pretty well in school. Mm-hmm. I didn't think school was very hard for the most part. And I remember one time bringing my dad my report card, and it was straight A minuses, which was still a 4.0 at my school. So like I was, it was flawless, you know, it didn't affect my GPA, but it was straight A minuses, right? And my dad said, okay, interesting. Did you do your best? I was like, well, you know, I mean, I got straight A's, Dad. He's like, yeah, but did you do your best? I was like, well, to be honest, I didn't really have to. Like it was like, I just, you know, it's fine. I did enough. And he goes, no, I'm sorry, Jeff. I'm disappointed.
What a question. And I was like, wow.
I was like, what? You're disappointed? I got straight A's, Dad. What do you want from me? And I got all emotional about it, right? He goes, no, you don't understand. Like, you could get C's, and if you did your best, I'd be happy. But doing really well, but not putting in your best effort, mm-hmm. That's not okay.
Wow. Well, that leads me to this. And Jeff, I'm not going to bait this question. I just want to have you speak into this quote from the book. You said, quote, the reason many of us never self-actualize is because it's easier to play a role in life than it is to become our true selves, end quote. Jeff, that's a heavy statement. Will you unpack that for us?
Yeah, well, the idea of self-actualization is we all have a true self. And I think life has a way of telling us when we're operating in our gifts, doing the things that make us come alive and doing the things that drain us. Yeah. You know, there are a lot of things that I could be reasonably good at, but they drain me, you mm-hmm. know? And so because of my personality and my wiring and my upbringing and all these things, I want to be doing the things that bring me life. And the way life tells you that this isn't the thing that you're supposed to be doing is through angst and sometimes jealousy. You see somebody else doing something and you go, that's what I want to be doing. I want to be playing music, right? Mm-hmm. And I talk to so many starving artists who have this longing to go do something, to go be someone, and that's all it is a longing. And it's scary. It's scary to step out and change your role. There's a story that I told when I was a kid about how when I was growing up, when I was in about sixth grade, so I was 12 years old, I had very long hair. It was the 90s after all. I wore a lot of flannel, was very much into grunge music.
Yeah.
And I was very chubby. Puberty was like around the corner but hadn't yet arrived. Uh-huh. So I'm very chubby. I've got long hair. I don't have a lot of masculine features. And I was often mistaken for a girl. And one day I had my first job was delivering newspapers. And, you know, after the first month or so of delivering newspapers, I went around and collected dues from all my clients. You know, you go knock on the door and say, hey, I've been delivering the paper to you. You know, this is what it costs to, you know, keep the subscription going. And that's where they, you know, give you tips and stuff. And I knocked on this one door of this older gentleman. He came out and he gave me this big tip and was just like really nice. And he said, my, what an enterprising young lady you are.
Oh, no.
I have no doubt that you'll be a great entrepreneur someday. And I was like, I mean, part of me was a little bit just intimidated because he was an adult and I wasn't, and I wasn't very outspoken as a kid. And then the other part was like, he just put a bunch of cash in my hand. Wow. And before I could say anything really, he said, okay, well, have a good day. And he closed the door and left. And I was like, oh no. And so the next time I knocked on his door a month later, in his mind, I was a young lady. So he, again, calls me a young lady, little girl, you know, these things. And it goes on for months and months and months. And I felt, because I didn't correct him the first time, because I didn't have the chance to go, no, wait, I'm a dude.
Do you sucker punch him the third time?
I honestly, I just lived with it.
Yeah.
I just lived with it. I went with it because, like I said, sometimes it's easier to play a role than it is to become our true selves. There's risk there. If I go, no, wait, you're misunderstanding things, you know, he could be surprised or offended or go, really? You know, it's embarrassing. And in some ways, it's just easier to play the roles that we've been given. So if you're growing up in, you know, and your mom or dad says, you got to join the family business and you don't really want to do that, you know, you want to be a painter instead of a plumber, like that causes angst. And so it's quote unquote easier to play the role that you've been given, but it tears you up inside. And I love that Maya Angelou quote where she says there is no greater agony than having a story stuck inside of you. And we all have something inside of us that wants to get out. And when it doesn't get out, when we're playing some role and we know that it's not our true self, that there's angst there, that's agony. And it's much better to step out and say, this is who I really am. Now I'm going to become it. And it's a scary thing, but it's also a very life-giving thing.
Jeff, as a communicator, I'm a sucker for alliteration. I can't help it. I love it. And in reading your book, this phrase really kept popping up in my mind. The consistency of convergence. In other words, what I gathered from the book is that consistency in an action in which you're gifted over time will yield profitable results. Such was the case when you wrote about John Grisham's Genesis as a writer. And I found it fascinating. You said he wrote one page every day for 365 days, 1 year, and the result was A Time to Kill. Would you speak to everyone joined in this conversation about a principle you and I discussed over coffee, and that is this: taking a leap of faith versus building a bridge.
Yeah. So I believe that it's better to build a bridge than take a leap. Yeah. You know, everybody talks about how do you succeed? How do you become a writer? How do you become a musician? How do you launch a business? And the answer is you do it one little step at a time. And when John Grisham decided that he wanted to be a writer, it wasn't so much a decision as it was a curiosity. He wondered, he had an affinity for writing, but he had never really done it professionally. And so he thought, can I do this? And I love that question. Do I even have what it takes before I go, you know, try to do something crazy like quit my job? Can I even handle this, right? And so what he did as a new lawyer and as a new dad is he got up a little early every day and went into the office and wrote a page, one page of a book called The Time to Kill. And it took him 2 years to finish his first manuscript. And he finished it. He said, well, that was fun. And he published it with a small publisher, and it didn't sell very well. But he was like, that was fun. Let me see if I could do it again. And he starts writing another book, which eventually became The Firm. A year later, that book was done. He sends it off to another publisher. Meanwhile, this book that he – his first book that he had published, A Time to Kill, he had bought some copies of it and started giving it away and selling it, marketing it on its own, and it was starting to sell pretty well. And so then he's able to sell this second book to a major publisher, and it becomes a bestseller. And so 3 to 4 years in the making, all of a sudden he becomes a quote-unquote overnight success. What he was doing during that time was, first of all, practicing the craft, seeing if this was enjoyable work, which I think is something very, very overlooked. Somebody goes, I want to do this full time. How much are you doing it right now? Well, I'm not, because I don't have enough time.
Yeah.
If you have that attitude, you will never have enough time. I write less per day now that I'm a full-time writer than I did when it was my hobby.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, I have flexibility. There are days where I get to write 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day if I want/need to. But on an average day, there's so many other non-writing related tasks, like the one I'm doing right now, which I'm very grateful for, that it is just as much a fight, if not more, to find time to write now as a full-time writer than it was then. If for no other reason than if I didn't get up and write every day at 7 a.m., it didn't get done. So what was I doing? I was getting up and writing from 6 to 7 a.m. Because that was the time I had to write. It's the same reason why when I have a gym membership with 24/7 unlimited access to the gym, I never work out. And when I join a class that meets from 6 to 7 a.m. every day, I have to show up, because if I miss it, I miss it. Does that make sense? And so the constraint creates opportunities for the work. And so, yeah, this idea that you're waiting for your big moment where like the stars are going to align and God is going to tell you, you know, you are an artist in whom I am well pleased. Like that's not the way it works. Yeah. Clarity comes with action. So we have to act our way into clarity. And big dreams are built not overnight, but slowly and intentionally. And there was a study that I read about this. This was always my assumption that this was the better way to do it, because for every person that we see succeed, when you kind of pull back the curtain, you find out, oh, no, no, no. Like there were years of practice that went into this before they hit it big. It wasn't just a giant leap of faith. I'm not saying that we don't take risks. We do, but the risks are almost always smaller than we think they should be. And I read a study not too long ago, which I put in the book, that was conducted at the University of Wisconsin, where they surveyed thousands of American entrepreneurs, and they did it over the course of 15 years. And the question they're trying to answer is it better to quit your job and start a business, or is it better to keep your job and gradually grow a business on the side and then eventually go full time once you've kind of reached a point of momentum? And what they found over the course of 15 years surveying thousands of entrepreneurs, the people who were more risk averse, they didn't take as many risks and they didn't quit their jobs, they built their businesses on the side and then eventually went full time. They were 33% more likely to succeed. Whereas the people who took the big risk, who went all in, who, you know, theoretically would have more time to focus on the business, were less successful, significantly so.
Right.
So even the statistics of this say it is better to build a bridge than it is to take a leap.
That's incredible truth. Jeff, I'd love to whet the appetite of everyone joined in today's conversation. I'm going to echo a few of the prominent keys from your book and ask you to briefly elaborate. Number one, you said the starving artist strives to be original, but the thriving artist steals from his influences.
Yep. So this idea is that we are all, those of us who want to be creative are going, I need to be original. I need to come up with a big idea. Well, this is not the way creative geniuses usher their work into the world. Austin Kleon talks about this in his book, Steal Like an Artist. And it comes from this quote, which is often attributed to Picasso, T.S. Eliot, a bunch of different people. We don't even know who said it. Mm-hmm. But the quote is, good artists copy, great artists steal. It turns out this is true across the board. Entrepreneurs, dancers, painters, they all do this. And what this means is that you are borrowing from lots of different influences and you're bringing it together into this thing that is called your style. It's not original, except that you're kind of borrowing from a bunch of different people and you're kind of adding your own interpretation and flair of it. And I think the best way to kind of summarize this is in the words of a historian by the name of Will Durant. He says that nothing is new except arrangement. And I like that a lot. So we're all borrowing from the same source material, but the way we arrange it, the way you combine those colors, the way you rearrange those, you know, those melodies and those notes, the way you take all these different ideas and turn them into, you know, different stories, like that is your art. And you can waste a lot of time going, I need one big great idea.
Right.
That's not how we create our best work. We create our best work in the context of community, around other people, borrowing from influences, assimilating them into our work, and then sharing them with the world. Somebody once asked Bono, how did you get that original sound that you two had? He goes, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
All we were trying to do was copy all these other bands around us, and we weren't good enough to be like them, and this is what came out.
Wow. Wow. Number two, you said the starving artist is stubborn about everything. The thriving artist is stubborn about the right things. Unpack that.
So all artists, I think, are pretty stubborn. And the challenge is that – and this goes back to your question about like somebody really, really wants it,
yeah,
but they're just struggling. They don't have what it takes, it seems, right? So – it could be that they're being stubborn about the wrong thing. And one of the things that I found fascinating when I was writing this book, I did a bunch of research reading stories of kind of successful, famous artists, musicians, creative entrepreneurs throughout history. But then I also surveyed a bunch of working creatives today, hundreds of them. And these were the things that they had in common, these 12 rules that are in the book. One of them was stubbornness. But what it was that they were stubborn about their vision. And they were flexible on the details. And so when they met opposition, instead of trying to just continue to do the same thing over and over again, they'd pivot around it, right? They would use their weaknesses and turn them into advantages. And Jeff Bezos from Amazon said, we are stubborn on vision but flexible on details. And the starving artist tends to be stubborn about everything. They're stubborn about the details. They're stubborn about what this looks like or feels like or what their friends will think. And the thriving artist is stubborn about the vision. They know what they want, but they're flexible in the details. However they get to that point, they're okay with.
Wow.
And when we get too caught up in the details, which is something that a lot of creatives can do, That's when we're going to hurt our work and we're going to kind of lose the long-term potential we have to do this work for a long time.
That's good. Jeff, number three, the starving artist does his work in private. The thriving artist practices in public.
This is this idea of marketing, right? Like I talk to lots of artists and they go, oh, you know, I don't want to do the marketing. Or even business owners will say, you know, I know somebody who owns a trophy store. They sell trophies, you know, for like sports teams and companies and anybody who wants to give an award to somebody. You know, and a lot of people just want to do their work. They don't want to worry about promoting it. Well, I think there's two ways to promote the work that you do. One is to think about it as self-promotion, which most people find pretty distasteful.
Definitely.
The other is to think about it like practicing in public. So what do you do when you practice in public? Well, you do what Picasso did, which is he moved to Paris. He realized that all these great artists are in Paris, but how do I stand out from all these people? How do I not starve? Picasso once said, I would like to live as a pauper, but with plenty of money. And that's what he did. He looked like a pauper, but he was very, very rich. How he became rich was by putting his work in front of the right people. And one of those people was Gertrude Stein, who was an art patron, an author, and a very well-connected woman in the early 20th century in the art scene in Paris. And every week she would host a salon, a gathering, a party at her house where she'd have all of the leading intellectuals and artists and thinkers in Paris over to her house and a lot of art patrons and art connoisseurs. And so what Picasso does is he goes, I'm going to paint her. And he marches across town. He meets her, you know, gets to know her, and offers to paint her. And the story goes he painted her over 100 times and gave her all the paintings. And what does she do? She hangs these up, you know, in her house and lets people see them. And they go, oh, who is that by? She goes, oh, that's Picasso. He's a new artist. You're going to have to check him out. What is that? Is that self-promotion? I don't know. I guess.
Yeah.
I think of it as practicing in public.
That's good.
It is him.
Right.
It is him doing what he does, right? He's doing his work, but he's doing it where an audience can see it and notice it. So going around, like he could have went around and plastered ads around downtown Paris and said artists for hire or something. And that would have not been satisfying to him, right? But practicing in public means we get to do our work, right? And we get to do it on a blog, on Instagram, you know, on the street corner. We get to do it someplace where as we grow, people are going to notice. And when we get to that point where we're so good that they can't ignore us, as Steve Martin once said, you already have an audience there ready to listen to and even pay you for your work.
That's so good. Folks, I want to pause real fast and let you know that the book Real Artists Don't Starve is available right now everywhere books are sold. But get this, I'm giving away 6 copies of the book, so stay tuned. After my conversation with Jeff, I'll tell you exactly what you need to do to enter to get your free copy of Jeff's newest book, Real Artists Don't Starve. Jeff, we live in a really speculative, cautious, protective culture, especially as it pertains to business ideas. You know, everyone's signing a non-disclosure agreement or, you know, between songwriting and art in general. And I've been so eager to ask this question of you. Why do you assert that genius happens in groups? It's like the example you gave in the book. You were talking about Beyonce and her 6th record. She had 72 writers on it. Because of that, people were enraged. What's with this self-protection and hiddenness regarding our work?
Well, we have this idea of the solitary genius. We think this is the way that creative geniuses do their best work. And it's just not true, Chris. I mean, everybody from Albert Einstein to Sigmund Freud to the choreographer and dancer Twyla Tharp, all these people did their work in the context of community. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't a point at which you have to go into the room by yourself and write the song, come up with the idea, finish the story. It is understood that there is a part of this work that we do in solitude, but there is a communal element to creativity that we cannot, and frankly often do, overlook. And the best work is done in the context of community, because how do you know that you're nailing it?
Yeah.
How do you know when you're getting it wrong? And there's a story in the book about the Inklings, which was a group of 19 men who met for decades. They met for years, and two of the guys in the group were J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis.
Oh, wow.
And one day the two guys go out for lunch, and they're professors at Oxford,
yep.
and they're friends because of this group, and they go out to lunch, and Tolkien says to Lewis, "Man, this new book that I'm working on, it's just really, I'm bored, I can't figure it out, I'm a few chapters in, I think I'm going to quit." And Lewis says, "Well, you know, tell me what's going on," and they talk back and forth, and Lewis gives his friend Tolkien some useful advice. Now, at this point, Tolkien had published his first book, The Hobbit, and it had done pretty well, and now he was under contract to write another book, which is what he called The New Hobbit. And Lewis says to Tolkien, he says, "Tolkien, don't you know that hobbits are only interesting when they're put in un-hobbit-like circumstances?" And this just, you know, turns on a light bulb for Tolkien, because here he is writing what will become The Lord of the Rings, and he can't get the hobbits out of the Shire. And he doesn't realize until he gets the hobbits out of the Shire, the story hasn't really begun.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've read that book or seen the movie, like, until they leave the Shire, you don't really have a story. Like, the Lord of the Rings is the story of them leaving the Shire and, you know, trying to destroy the ring. This becomes one of the most popular works of literature in all of history. It would not have been written if J.R.R. Tolkien believed in the idea of a solitary genius. He needed the feedback and correction from his friend to guide him through the process. And yes, he went back into a room by himself and wrote it, but creation, actually bringing something into the world, is a collaborative effort, not just some solitary invention.
That's awesome. What a principle to apply to our lives, guys. Listen, maybe you have a small business, maybe you're developing a skill and wanting to just kind of get into the market. Go back, rewind, listen to that last statement Jeff made, because I really believe it's going to add value to focusing your energy in this season. Jeff, let's go to this next part of that question, I suppose. I'd love to talk about building an audience for your work. You made this statement in the book: before art can have an impact, it must first have an audience. Would you really just break this principle down really practically for those of us who endeavor to create and share our work? Question is this more about giving people what they want or putting our work out to market even while it's in creation, or maybe neither?
I think it's both.
Okay.
I think you're dancing with the expectations of the market. Step one is you have to practice in public. You have to share a piece of your art every single day. I don't care how big that is. I don't care how done it is. You need to share something with the world every day. This is the best way to stay honest as a creative.
Okay.
Because what that will do is it will make sure you're showing up and doing the work, which, Chris, is the number one challenge that most of us have. Say you want to start a business. Say you want to take up guitar. Say you want to become a writer. You have to do this. You have to work on this every single day.
Yeah.
For a little bit of time, 30 minutes, something. And this is the biggest struggle that most people have. If you put your work on display every single day, so when I started, I said, maybe I could be a writer. I'm gonna write a new blog post on my blog every single day so that I can't hide. I talked to lots of visual artists where they said, I resolved to share a piece of my art every day on Flickr or Instagram or Facebook. And when they did that, I mean, sometimes it was just taking a picture of a work in progress or saying, hey, here's my workspace. It doesn't have to be a finished, completed, published work. It just has to be a snippet, a piece of the work that you're doing. So that's step one, practice in public. Step two, do the work of finding an audience. And it is easier to go find a group of people that need your work than it is to stay stuck in one place and say, come to me, everybody. Mm-hmm. Right? So go to the places, both digitally and physical, where people are that need your work. Conferences, forums, Facebook groups, wherever the people that you're trying to reach are. Go there.
Yes.
If you're a craft maker, go to a fair and then bring your work and let them see it. And then lastly, you at some point have to find out what they want and how you can help them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I like what Derek Sivers says about this. He says, what's obvious to you is amazing to others. So do you get to do what you want to do, or do you have to do what they do? If you want to build a career, you want to make a living off of your creativity, you have to do both. You have to find the thing that resonates with you, that is your genius. And it may be something very obvious to you, so obvious that you've overlooked it.
Yeah.
But then you also have to find the intersection of that genius with the demand, with the needs of other people, where they go, wow, that's amazing. And the only way I know how to do that is to get in conversation with the people that you want to serve, the people that you want to help, the audience that you want to engage. So I think those three things are important. Practice in public, find an audience, and then ultimately ask the audience what they want. Find, you know, get some sort of feedback from them so that you can ultimately provide that service, that product, even the way that you create it to them in a way where they're going to go, wow, this is amazing.
That's fantastic. Last question, but it's really important.
Okay.
Finish this sentence. Besides avocado, the perfect guacamole must include the following ingredients.
All right.
Bacon.
Pretty passionate about. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to give you the essential ingredients and then a fun bonus ingredient. So you've got to have lime juice, fresh lime.
I agree.
Salt and pepper to taste, yep. Cilantro, lots of cilantro. You cannot overdo the cilantro unless you're like whatever it is, the 20 or 30% of the population
yeah.
Makes it taste like soap.
Right.
So but weird. You're crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
A tomato, I like a diced Roma tomato, garlic, again, fresh, has to be fresh.
Yeah.
And I think that's it. The bonus ingredient that I would put in there is pomegranate seeds. Super fun.
What?
Yeah.
You've got to be kidding me.
No, it's fun.
All right. So, you know, you guys listening, if you're anywhere in the Metro Detroit area, you know about this place. It's called Hancho. Jeff, it just opened. It's Latin American street food, and there are sweet peas in the guacamole. It's unbelievable.
Sweet peas.
Sweet peas. Come to Detroit. I'll buy you all dinner. Right. Bring Ashley and the kids up. We'll hang with Mark and Diana. We'll go get sweet pea guacamole. I'm telling you, man, it's unbelievable.
Awesome. I'll try it.
Yeah, it's really unbelievable.
I will come all the way to Detroit just for that.
That would be fantastic. Well, Jeff, listen, thank you so much for being here. Guys, again, the book, Real Artists Don't Starve, it's available right now everywhere books are sold. And like I said, stay tuned because I'm going to give you an opportunity to get your copy totally free. I've got 6 to give away. So, Jeff, thank you, my friend. I really believe this is your best work to date. I'm so proud of you and encouraged for myself. I couldn't put the book down.
Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate that.
You're welcome. Well, go get it. Keep doing what you're doing, and we'll talk again soon, Jeff. Thanks.
Thank you.
What a fantastic conversation with Jeff Goines. If you'd like to read his blog, you can find him at goineswriter.com. That's goineswriter.com. Recapping today's conversation, Jeff made a few key statements. Number one, he said, it's not fake it until you make it. It's believe it until you become it. Number two, Jeff said, the starving artist strives to be original. The thriving artist steals from his influences. This applies to you whether you're a business professional, artist, musician, teacher, or any creative professional. Number three, Jeff said, we find ourselves on the cusp of transformation. The question to ask ourselves is, are we willing to become our true selves? Isn't that good? Okay, guys, so here's what you've been waiting for. If you'd like a chance to win a copy of Jeff's newest book, I'll pay the shipping. Here's what you need to do. Follow me on Instagram. I'm at 00ChrisCook. Record a video in your Instagram story of you saying, I listen to Win Today with Christopher Cook on iTunes. You should too. Tag me in the story, then make sure you put the hashtags Win Today Show and Don't Starve Book. The first 6 people to do this will win a free copy of Jeff's newest book. I'll private message you with instructions to email me your address. Guys, thanks again for joining us today. Don't miss next week's episode. I'll be talking with another best-selling author about why willpower never works. Until next time, visit me over at chriscookis.com for blogs and archived podcasts, all designed to help you become the best you're capable of becoming. Have an awesome week. Bye-bye.